I'm George Knapp in tonight for George Norrie. Good song choice by the illustrious Michelle there at Premiere in the control booth. Donovan from way back in 1968, Atlantis. That was a big worldwide hit for Donovan. And there was Scuttlebutt that continues to this day that Paul McCartney sang background vocals on that song. He is uncredited on any of the recorded versions, though. That sort of perfectly sets the tone for the rest of tonight's program, and I think it's going to be a good one. Legends and stories about places like Atlantis, ancient Egypt, and where the pyramids really came from, ancient Incas and Mayans, the Chinese, the Greeks, the Romans, all the cultures, all the ancient cultures and peoples seem to have stories about these beings, these people, gods, if you will, that came from the sky and interacted with humans on various levels. And that is the main topic that is explored by the History Channel's series, Ancient Aliens. This series produced in part by Giorgio Tsoukalos, who's my guest, and we're going to jump right into it with him to talk about the show, its future, and some of the topics it's covered already right here on Coast to Coast AM. Giorgio Tsoukalos has been on the program before. This is my first chance to interview him, though. He is, of course, the consulting producer of the show Ancient Aliens, and he's the publisher of Legendary Times magazine, sort of a Indiana Jones real-life character. For the past 12 years, or at least for 12 years, he was the director of Eric von Daniken's Center for Ancient Astronaut Research. Of course, anybody who follows these topics would recognize von Daniken's name, famous all over the world, sold millions and millions of his books, and people are really interested in this topic. Giorgio, great to have you on the show.
Absolutely, and it's a total honor to do this show with you for the first time. I'm really stoked about this.
I am too, and I'll bet people say to you, hey, I know you. You're the guy with the hair.
It just happened tonight. I was walking around here in Hollywood, and it happens. And you know what? It's wonderful that people have the urge to come and say hello, and because that to me means that their hearts, their souls have been reached with the message that the History Channel's Ancient Aliens provides. And it's truly amazing that so many people are excited about the show. I mean, I feel very, very happy about that.
I get that too. People will say, well, don't you get tired of people coming up and talking to you about UFOs and aliens and stuff? And I say, absolutely not. I mean, I get stopped in the grocery store, in restaurants, in the men's room, pretty much everywhere. And it's mostly people, you know, they want to ask me about my experiences or knowledge or information, but mostly it's they want to tell about their experiences.
That too. And that is the wonderful thing, that number one, there is such a thirst for knowledge out there. And number two, there are so many people that have had experiences themselves. And that leads me to think that, you know, not all of these people are crazy, because that would mean that the entire planet essentially is nuts, which it is, but not in that sense. So, you know, when people come up to us and they talk to us about their experiences, I mean, you know, that is a very courageous step for anyone to do this. So to immediately suggest, as the debunkers or the critics would say, that, you know, oh, those people are just schizophrenic or crazy, or they don't know what they're talking about, or they just saw a weather balloon or you know, sleep paralysis or something like this. That, to me, that is, you know, very arrogant to make such accusations or such statements.
Well, I think it's on purpose, too. We don't have to get into this. We can later on if you want, but as you know from more recent times, not ancient times, but more recent times, that the American government has made a point to institute a ridicule factor, a laughter curtain, where you make fun of people and make it harder for them to come forward with their stories, make it harder for people in my line of work to take it seriously or for scientists to look at it. That's not accidental.
Yeah, I mean, look, that of course can be debated, and but there's definitely something going on, and in my opinion, I think it is also part of what I like to call the Great Awakening, and that's not just, you know, a term that I came up with, but that's just what we're talking about in general, that by and large, mankind is waking up to these types of ideas, and so, you know, we are living in extremely, extremely exciting times. And it's just, you know, it's just all of this is very awesome.
Talk to me about the show. A third season just starting. That is a great accomplishment. I mean, a heck of a lot of shows. Most TV shows probably don't make it that far. You got to feel pretty good.
Yes. And thank you very much. I mean, I couldn't be more delighted and proud of the achievement. And, you know, I mean, just on July 28th, 3 days ago on Thursday, the first episode of season three aired. And we have 15 more episodes to go for the remainder of this season. So we're going to be on the air for at least the 3.5 months, which is fantastic. And like you said, this is season three. It's a great achievement. First episode or first season had 5 2-hour programs. The second season had 10 one-hour programs. And this season will have, as I said, 16 one-hour episodes. And, you know, it's and we're still talking about the same topic, and we're still exploring and finding new stuff. I mean, that's the great thing. I mean, obviously, the idea has remained the same. I mean, the show essentially explores the idea whether or not extraterrestrials visited Earth in the remote past. And by extraterrestrials, we are, of course, referred to as flesh and blood extraterrestrials. And, you know, with the topics that we're discovering or talking about in season three, there are many, many topics that we have not yet covered in seasons one and two because, as you know, this is a fairly, fairly vast topic. I mean, there's stuff from all around the world that we can look at, any ancient culture. And so I'm very excited about it. And I can tell you right now, season three has a lot of surprises in store as well.
Well, we'll jump into that. But before I want to stay with the business side of it for a second. What does the network tell you? What did the History Channel people tell you about how well they like it, how the show is doing in the numbers, and what the future holds?
Well, they obviously love it. Otherwise, we wouldn't be back, which means the ratings must be fairly acceptable and great. So, you know, because unfortunately in this day and age, it is all about ratings. And I'm really stoked that the fans love the show. So big shout out to the fans that are tuning in, all the Tsukalonians and the Tsukalicious Tsukalettes. And so, you know, the network is truly happy with what is going on. And at the same time, I can truly say that, you know, because a lot of times you can read on Twitter or on Facebook how, you know, there is an information ban out there and there are certain things that we can't talk about. And I've worked on this show now for over 2 years, and not once have we been told that this is something that we can't talk about. And that, to me, means that the gates are opening and that there's a much more open-minded attitude towards this entire topic because, let's be honest, otherwise this show would not be on a national TV channel. And so, to me, I think it's just, you know, it just is a part of this whole, you know, paradigm shift that we're all a part of right now.
I would imagine, though, there are difficulties in producing the show. And production value is really good, by the way. You know, weave in these academic guys, and I want to ask you about that because it must cause them some kind of heartburn to be associated with the show at some level. But the graphics, and you have to go to some very touchy places, Middle East, for example. I would imagine you've got some war stories.
Well, you know, and I'm really glad that you picked up on the idea or on the fact that the production value of the show is tremendous. And, you know, it's true because just even if somebody is not really into the topic, I've heard so many times where people just watch the show because it's really beautiful to look at. I mean, it's beautifully shot. The footage is fantastic, the stills and you know, the entire way it's been cut together by this incredible team that we have. And yes, you know, we don't spare any expense. We have teams traveling all around the world. I mean, we just had somebody that went to Cusco, Peru only a couple of weeks ago filming, you know, on location. So most of the footage that you see on the show, especially if, you know, you have some of the experts talking right in front of the monuments, I mean, that was all, you know, that's all original material. So, you know, we've really, you know, gone above and beyond to bring, quote unquote, real stuff to the audience. And I think that is what sets this series apart. And yes, I mean, there's, of course, always war stories and war stories that have been going on since, you know, I've been traveling, you know, starting to travel since I was, you know, a little kid. There's been crazy stuff been going on my travels. So, but, you know, that's what makes it exciting.
Since I touched on it briefly, I want to talk about your use of academics, because I know for a professor at UCLA or USC or some of the other universities you rely on to have these guys come up and be interviewed for the program, I would imagine they frown on the general topic covered by the show. Is it difficult to get these folks to come on and speak in general? I know you don't have them saying aliens visited us, but they do speak to the general topic and fill in a lot of blanks.
Well, here is the thing, and I'm sure that if you've seen the first two seasons, and if the fans have who have been watching the first two seasons very closely, I mean, I know some people who have watched each episode, 10, 20 times. So they're real hardcore diehard fans, which is awesome. And at the same time, though, if you look at the previous two seasons, like in season one, we had academics on there. In season two, we had more academics on there. And one thing I can say is that in season three, there will be even more academics on the show. Now, each and every season, when we contacted these university professors, scholars, scientists, whatever, not once did we say, "Hi, this is calling. This is the production company calling for the History Channel on a yet-to-be-titled program." From the very first moment, we said, "Here we are calling for the History Channel from a program called Ancient Aliens." And the fact that in season three, we have more academics on board than in all the previous seasons combined, that to me is a telltale sign that the tides are in fact changing, because nobody is holding a gun to these professors' heads saying, "You have to appear on the show." Quite on the contrary. So they are familiar with the show, and they, quote unquote, volunteer to be on the program. And that, George, is huge. I mean, that is something that is completely unheard of, or would have been unheard of, let's say, in the 70s or in the 80s or even in the 90s.
Yeah, I think it adds a lot of heft to the credibility of the presentations. But I think it also is a testament that you haven't screwed them over, that you haven't edited an interview from one of these guys and end up having them say, "Yes, aliens were here, and I've seen, I believe in
Right.
ETs."
And we have never done that, and you're absolutely correct, where in Ancient Aliens, any expert that appears on the show, they're actually allowed, not allowed, but, if you, because we both know that with editing, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
However, we have not crossed the line ever to take somebody's statements out of context. And you're absolutely right that the professors aren't necessarily saying that, yes, the ancient astronaut theory is 100% correct. But I'm sorry, by appearing on the program, you inherently imply that by just being on the program, that there is something there that they're excited or at least interested about. And, as one of the astrophysicists or astronomers said in the first season, she said that if the ancient astronaut theory were to be correct, that would be a huge positive thing for science in general. And that's a professor of astronomy at a major U.S. university. So for somebody to say something like that, I mean, it's huge. It really is.
Well, you look at some of the folks you've interviewed, and you just know that they were inspired maybe by the Indiana Jones movies, that to get into archaeology or anthropology. They're inspired to do that because they want to solve mysteries. They want to get their hands dirty and figure out what the truth is about ancient peoples and where we came from as a species and where we're going. So I would think that there is a lot of hunger for honest research on the part of these academics. And if you're right that you've now provided a platform for more of them to come forward, that's a big development.
No, and the thing is also that, most of the stuff that we talk about in Ancient Aliens, especially when I'm on the program or I'm on the air, or David Childress or Eric von Däniken and Jason Martell, Philip Coppens, the stuff that we talk about, it's not something that we pulled out of our butts. It's something that any one of us can go out in the world, travel to all these remote sites, and see and photograph and measure those sites the way they exist. I mean, none of that stuff that we present was, you know, pulled out of thin air. Now, of course, the interpretation, in our opinion, is 100% ancient astronaut related. However, it's not like we're talking about, you know, lofty ideas where we say, well, you know, we think that this site exists somewhere. No, any one of our listeners, we can all go there right now and check it out for ourselves. And there are certain sites all around the world where we today would have great difficulty recreating them with modern-day machinery. And that's where it gets interesting.
Well, I think one of the differences, maybe it's a reason why you've been able to stick around into your third season and other shows have gone away, is the different expectations. You know, you've had UFO shows and these ghost hunter shows, and they're out there and they have to produce something. They're shooting this stuff in modern times. They're expected to come up with UFO video or ghost video or something. You're dealing with stuff that happened to a large extent a long time ago.
Yeah.
I would think that the expectations are somewhat different.
Well, yes, and that is, you know, and that is sometimes, you know, I get asked the question, well, what do you think about this most recent UFO story? And I got to be honest with you. Look, I love ufology. I think that the experts in this field are doing a fantastic job. But personally, I really don't have a great expert opinion on modern-day UFOs, because my UFOs, they happened or they appeared thousands and thousands of years ago, and you know, for all intents and purposes, I mean, they were the UFOs of that time. So, you know, I really think that therein lies the difference, because we have thousands of years of references, textual and in oral traditions, in paintings, in carvings, in figurines, statues, monuments, what have you, you know, dating back to the beginning of time, essentially. And, you know, there's something happened in our past that still today, you know, merits a satisfying explanation. And that's what we're trying to do here.
You started off season three with sort of using the Cowboys and Aliens movie as a theme for looking at aliens or ancient aliens in the Old West. I want to jump into that, and I'm not sure how much you want to reveal about the season coming up. Are you going to be able to give us sort of a laundry list of what's coming? And you don't have to give it now, but just in general, are you going to be able to tell us much?
I can tell you something. Yes, of course. I can't reveal everything, otherwise you won't tune in. But yes, I can definitely whet your appetite for sure.
All right. Well, we'll talk about when we come back. I want to jump into the Cowboys and Aliens and the possibility of ETs in the Old West. I want to get into some broader questions with you about best evidence overall after going into your third season, what you would point to as the best evidence for the ancient aliens theory. And then at some point, I want to get into criticisms of the show, because I am sure you've been just hammered by some of the same crew who always attack the modern UFO theories as well, and who probably your show just drives them up the wall.
And that's just fine.
All right. And Giorgio, we'll do all of that and more after this break on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us, everyone. Great old tune from Paul McCartney and Wings, Spirits of Ancient Egypt. I think you know why that fits the topic tonight. We'll be talking about spirits of ancient Egypt and other ancient cultures with my guest, Giorgio Tsoukalos. He's the consulting producer of Ancient Aliens, the series on the History Channel. And of course, as you might expect, there's archaeologists who hear this show and it sounds to them like fingernails on a blackboard. It drives them crazy. We'll get into some of the criticisms that have been launched and jump right into the first episode of the new season dealing with cowboys and aliens right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Giorgio Tsoukalos, season three of Ancient Aliens starts with a look at aliens in the Old West. And I'm not sure that qualifies as ancient, but it certainly is historic and interesting. Tell me this. I guess the timing, of course, with the movie coming out has a lot to do with why you started with this, right? That episode?
Absolutely. And that's not even a secret. I mean,
yeah.
The idea, in my opinion, to spread the ancient astronaut theory is basically to take advantage of any type of vehicle that's legitimate that we can, you know, approach with. And so the fact that Harrison Ford, of all people, you know, Indiana Jones himself and Han Solo happens to be in a movie called Cowboys and Aliens, and Of course, the release date of the movie was never, you know, they never said, you know, by the way, we know that Ancient Aliens is going to air that weekend. It was the other way around. We knew that Cowboys and Aliens is going to air. And, I mean, it would have been a ridiculous decision not to, you know, try to cross-promote it. Because my idea is always to reach as many as possible from a new audience. And so, you know, yeah, you're absolutely right that, you know, Cowboys and Aliens or that time of human history can't really be considered ancient. And that is absolutely true. But there are stories in the Old West from 100 or 200 years ago that do talk, and especially, you know, with the Native American myths and legends, that star people were here in the past.
Well, I definitely want to jump into that because, and of course, you know, as you look at the broad scope of your series, it appears that these kinds of tales, these myths, if you want to call them, but stories, are in every culture, including Native Americans. And that's a topic I have a particular interest in doing some of my own research for a book we wrote about. And I'd like you to talk about the Native American connection, because you listen to some of the creation stories of different tribes, and they all are so similar, how we came into this world and who is here in the world with us. It sure as heck sounds a lot like alien stories that we hear in other cultures.
Yes, of course. And see, and here's the magnificent thing that obviously in the Native American stories, they talk about, you know, ant people, or they talk about the underworld, or they talk about, you know, the Kachinas or flying shields. So it all sounds very, very fantastical, something that is completely, you know, has a mythological air to it. However, the question that I ask is, well, what was it exactly that our ancestors witnessed here? What did they try to describe? Because, come on, let's be honest. We all know that ant people do not exist. So is it possible that, you know, they saw some type of creatures that maybe possibly reminded them of ants? Because one thing we have to remind ourselves that our human intelligence, our brain has pretty much not changed in the last 25,000 years. So intellectually speaking, or from an intellectual grasp perspective, it doesn't matter if you bring a person from 25,000 years ago into the present, that person would be able to learn how to drive a car, even how to fly a plane, because intellectually they're totally capable of doing this. However, the great difference lies in the fact that the technological frame of reference that our ancestors had was way smaller than the technological frame of reference that we have today. So when they saw something flying up in the sky, some nuts and bolts craft, then of course they could not say that's a spaceship or an airplane because the vocabulary did not exist. But guess what? They all knew what a shield looks like, and that shield in particular, or that thing that they saw up in the air, it reminded them of a shield, so they said, okay, here we have a flying shield, even though it never was a flying shield. And in regards to Native Americans, if you look at the train that was built, it was always called the fire horse. If you look at the way they described a car, for example, if you look at the grill of a car, that was described as the mouth, the eye, or the lights were the eyes. So all these different words that they were familiar with in their vocabulary, they tried to describe all these technological things that they described with terms from a living being, for example. And now we know that the fire horse, in that sense, wasn't a horse on fire. It was a nuts and bolts train. So that is the great task or the great quest, to essentially look at all of these ancient stories. If they're 200 years old or 2,000 years old, doesn't really matter. And just to determine if there's a very odd description or a bizarre description of an event, to determine what is it that our ancestors really tried to describe, you know, looked at from a modern-day perspective, essentially.
Help me understand the Native American connection, if there is one, to paranormal events. I saw one in my own research. It seemed like everywhere there was a UFO or paranormal hotspot, and there are some around the country,
yep.
that there was a Native American, a strong Native American presence there. And I'm just wondering, when you speak to Native Americans, it's almost as if their connection to these stories, call them legends or myth, are far more current than for other cultures, that somehow these are things that they have not forgotten or discarded as other cultures, other peoples have.
And you're absolutely right. In fact, we have to remind ourselves that until fairly recently, all of the Native American traditions were only passed on in an oral fashion. So they were very adamant about trying to keep their traditions as close to the quote-unquote truth as they could. So they were very, you know, serious in trying to keep their stories as unembellished as possible, passing them down from generation to generation. And so it doesn't really matter what ancient American culture or Native American culture you talk about, but their creation stories, and obviously, like you said before, creation stories are pretty much identical all around the world, but since we're talking about Native Americans, you know, they describe how this planet, that life started out by the star people or the star brothers having seeded this planet with life, meaning that life essentially came here in its complete form. Now, obviously, that sounds all very fantastical. It sounds all, you know, quote-unquote crazy, but if we look at modern science, there actually exists a very valid theory out there called directed panspermia. And directed panspermia suggests nothing else that some type of an extraterrestrial race decided to send out these pods into the universe, into the galaxy, and just like you would try to seed your lawn, you just take a bunch of seeds and you throw it across the lawn, and somewhere the seeds will grow and somewhere they don't. And even, you know, if you have like a little bit of concrete in your yard, there are even areas in the concrete with a little crack or something where you will see a little leaf of grass sprouting eventually. And so that is the idea of directed panspermia, where pods containing the building blocks for life have been sent out throughout the universe from one or two or multiple intelligent civilizations trying to foster life or to create life throughout the universe. And as far as the Native Americans are concerned, that is exactly what they're talking about. And not only that, but they also talk about actual physical visitors that they refer to as the Kachinas, for example. And anyone that is familiar or has ever been to Arizona or, you know, Nevada or any, you know, area with Native American populations, if you go to their souvenir shops or to any type of Native American store, you can see these wonderful, wonderful wood carvings of these Kachinas. And yes, many of them look like they kind of like with feathers and animal-like, but there are some that look like modern-day astronauts with bizarre suits, with helmets, with antenna and tubes and things like that. And then the Kachina story is very, very simple and very, very clear that these guys descended from the sky and gave knowledge to our Native American ancestors. And here we are today, and well, not we, you, not you and me and our listeners, but here we are, the scientists or the archaeologists of today saying, well, that all these stories are nothing else but fantasy. Now that to me, George, is an insult in our ancestors' face.
Well, you know, we here in Nevada, we have a lot of petroglyphs left by Native people, some thousands of years old. I love going out into the desert and seeing them and helping to preserve them.
Yeah.
But they're very accurate in their portrayal of everyday life for
yeah.
Native peoples. I mean, they accurately draw themselves. They draw themselves hunting. There are some in a place called Sloan Canyon outside of Las Vegas where they record the first arrival of white settlers, and they draw these things on the rock, these strange people with their strange hats, and they're very accurate. And then yet you see some other petroglyphs here and around the world that Native peoples have drawn, cave walls, things that look like spacesuits, space helmets, astronauts, ancient astronauts. We are told by critics, and you've heard it many times, I'm sure. These are just animal skins on these people's heads. Well, I don't know. They look like antennas to me.
No, you know? You're absolutely right, and I'm kind of getting goosebumps here that you would even, you know, bring up that exact example, because you're 100% correct. Our ancestors were incredible artists, so they knew how to draw themselves, and they knew how to draw animals and, you know, hunter-gatherer scenes and things like that. And then all of a sudden, in those quote-unquote really accurate pictures, the other stuff that depicts these really bizarre humanoid astronaut-looking like creatures or beings or flying shields in the sky, all that is allegedly, that means nothing. That's just, you know, something that sprung out of their imagination, an imagination that was completely devoid of, at the time, of any, you know, a collective conscious that happened before. I mean, today, our collective conscious, obviously, is huge. But at the beginning of our history, there was no collective conscious. So to suggest, because I've heard this before, or I've heard somebody say that, you know, all these petroglyphs are just, they were basically just the comic books of their day. Now think about that for a moment. I mean, it's a complete logical fallacy to suggest such a thing, because it would mean that our ancestors knew what a comic book is, and that is completely ridiculous.
Well, I think what they would be saying is maybe that was the sci-fi of their day, that these guys were creating these creatures with space helmets,
right,
out of thin air as their own expressive art form.
And you just hit the nail on the head with the term out of thin air, because today in psychology, doctors have determined that nothing comes out of nothing. So nobody can invent a story unless there has been some sort of an initial spark of inspiration, where something was seen that either came from the sky or something, or rather, because, you know, critics say, oh, you know, it's just nature that they were all afraid of, or thunder and lightning and rain. But since when does nature give instructions? Since when does lightning say, you know, go over here and let me show you about agriculture and things like that? So, I mean, it's all very, very interesting to see. And so what the psychologists have suggested also is that, you know, you can't, for example, solve an algebraic equation without knowing the basics for math. And what we're suggesting is that the ancient alien visit was essentially the basics for math, and then everything else followed. And it's a very compelling argument.
I thought one of the most interesting, perhaps the most interesting part of the season 3 premiere, Aliens in the Old West, was about this, what may be the first UFO crash in North America, 80 or so years before Roswell, mm-hmm. 1865 in Great Falls, Montana. Tell that story, because I'd never heard it before.
Yeah, I mean, something was reported in the paper, and that something came crashing down, and it was, you know, at the time, these things were very quote-unquote rare things, and nobody had any, you know, vested interest in falsifying stories, as today, you know, is sort of now the norm, you know, to leave out things and to add things and things like that. But back in the day, I would say that, you know, the intentions of the newspapers were, you know, a bit more pure than they are today. And so, you know, this event happened where, you know, it's still a mystery today of, you know, what happened there. And all around the world, we have similar stories. I mean, in Russia, we got Tunguska and things like that. So, I mean, there still are so many unanswered questions out there that it baffles the mind when somebody says that, why are you even talking about this? Because this has been debunked. It has not.
Yeah, this case was 1865 outside Great Falls, Montana. A trapper saw this thing flash out of the sky and crash. And I guess the next day he went and tracked it down to see what it was that slammed into the earth, this fiery object. He found what looked like a great big rock, but he said he had told the newspaper it had chambers inside of it, and something that was compared in the newspaper article to hieroglyphs. And And then there were hints that this thing came down, according to your program, right in the area populated by the Blackfoot tribe, which had a strong tradition of belief in star beings, things of that sort. I just thought it was a fascinating account. And I just wonder what happened to the rock and the chambers and the hieroglyphs.
Yeah, no, and that is, that of course is or remains a great mystery. And personally, I don't know. Now, the interesting thing about the Native Americans is also that they have these amazing stories of the Thunderbirds. And if you look at totem poles, at the very top, usually these Thunderbirds are carved. They're these magnificent giant birds that allegedly descended from the sky a long time ago. And now in modern days, cryptozoologists have suggested that these might be dinosaurs that have flying dinosaurs that have survived over the millennia or millions of years, and that they, while they fly around, that is how, and by flapping their wings, that is how they create the thundering noise. Now, someone like me that comes from a more nuts and bolts and an ancient alien perspective, to me, when I look at the stories of these thunderbirds, the first question I ask is, okay, how is this even possible? Because obviously these stories are virtually identical all around the Native American cultures, but they're also very weird because sometimes the thunderbirds are described as having the skin made out of metal that was impenetrable to bows and arrows and things like this. And when I hear thunderbirds, you see, I immediately start thinking, well, is it possible that this was not at all a living being as a biological organism, but that it might have been some type of a flying machine, a vehicle that if a plane takes off, the way it sounds, the way it roars, it's the same description that Native Americans have contributed to those thunderbirds. And, people have flown around inside these thunderbirds and stuff like that. So, you can't do that. You can't be swallowed up by a big giant bird, fly around, and then, you're being you, they you're getting regurgitated and you pop back out of the beak. It's not possible. I mean, that is fantasy. So what was it that was described? And halfway around the world, in India, we have stories of Garuda, which is also a quote-unquote thunderbird, and it was described as the flying chariot of Indra, and he was able to open up Garuda's belly, go inside and steer him and drive him around. And to me, that is nothing else but misunderstood technology that was described with vocabulary that was available to our ancestors at the time.
Well, I will tell you from personal knowledge that there are stories of Thunderbirds still floating around in the Southwest among the Navajo and Hopi, and I'm not sure what to make of those. We continue our conversation with Georgios Tsoukalos about ancient aliens, going to get into some controversies and other stories that they are pursuing right after this break. Dire Straits taking us into the break on Coast to Coast AM.